But we start today with our philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota. We talk once a month about various topics, and today's topic is about sport and politics. How do they mix, and does treating politics as sport devalue it? It's my pleasure to welcome back to Main Street our philosophical currents man, and that's Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a philosophy instructor, professor at the University of North Dakota. Dr. Weinstein, it's a pleasure to visit with you again.
Oh, it's always wonderful to be here.
Before we start, we have this. This is a regular feature for Main Street, right? Philosophical currents. And all of our other folks who have a regular feature have their own walk-up music, so to speak, Jack. So if you were to have walk-up music that we would play before we do this, what would it be?
Oh, I have always joked that... This will reveal the 90s guy in me, that it's what a man, what a man, what a man, what a mighty fine man, because there's a great line, a body like Arnold and a Denzel face.
My man is smooth like Barry and his voice got bass. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep.
That's, you know, how could that be more Jack?
We will work on that for next month's philosophical currents. But walk-up music is like sport and sports, right, Jack? People have their walk-up music when they come to the plate, when they're announced in basketball. And our topic today is, does the term sport of politics undermine then the importance of politics, Jack? And what made you think of that question?
You know, I was very interested in the spectacle of the convention and how much not just the process caught people's eye, but also the guests and the, you know, the balloons and all of that sort of thing. And there is a part of me, the sort of the philosopher with one foot perpetually in classical Greece, that makes me think this is a little unseemly. There is a kind of dignity to a democracy. There is a kind of honor in being a citizen. And at its best, a convention can bring that out. But at its worst, it becomes a political circus. And I was really wondering, to what extent does this undermine that sense of dignity, purpose, and honor to have guys who are playing drums while upside down or what have you?
An election at its very core is a competition. Might you be able to think that defining it as a sport or a competition may in fact enhance public interest and therefore make a more informed electorate?
Well, I think that's right. Because again, with that foot in classical Greece, there was a real attitude, both in Greece and in Rome, that being a citizen was the highest type of person, that it was the most noble, the best thing that you can be. This became problematic because women were not allowed to be citizens, and slaves obviously were not, but in and of itself as a description of humanity, that being a citizen was the thing that we should strive for. In the United States, we don't really hold to that anymore. We have to persuade people to be citizens. We have to persuade people to have a kind of community-mindedness, whether it's from the not in my backyard kind of people to the I hate to pay taxes kind of people to I'm not going to help raise your kid people. There is always, there's always ever present this undercurrent of resistance. And since the last number I heard is 50%, you may have a different number, but since about 50% of people don't vote, there has to be some way to get folks to care enough, to get excited enough, to be enthusiastic enough to vote, let alone to donate to the candidate. So absolutely, I think that this is essential in terms of motivating, but I think that the roots of the motivation or the lack thereof run very, very deep in our political tradition.
I think the Secretary of State's office in this state would be thrilled, Jack, if 50% of the people voted. And that has been a surprise to me, at least in the elections that I've seen so far. This will be the first presidential election that I've been able to participate in as a North Dakotan. But I've been surprised at really the lack of enthusiasm for any of the electoral questions that have been presented since I've been here.
And that becomes super extreme when you're involved in local elections. I mean, I don't know what it's like in the smallest of towns where there are a few hundred people and there's a very different sentiment. But in Grand Forks, in Fargo, if it's a summer election or if it's a non-presidential year or something like that, the numbers drop even more. And what's surprising to me is that people don't understand that in that instance, 2 votes, 4 votes, 8 votes, they really do make a difference. It may not be the case that in most presidential or even gubernatorial elections that a small handful of people could win the day, but in Grand Forks, let alone Rugby, a small handful of people could absolutely win the day. And so then why aren't people vying to be that small handful of people? Right. Again, let's look at the sports metaphor for a second. You know, if your team really has a shot to go to the World Series, you're going to work extra hard. And so if your team has the opportunity to push the citizen referendum or get your person on the city council
or
what
have you, race or whatever,
yeah,
sure.
Why doesn't that make you more enthusiastic rather than less enthusiastic? And so there is something about the political game that is in opposition to the sports game, because the more likely you are to win in politics, the less enthusiastic you are. And that's just kind of weird.
The tax questions that have been presented and the lack of enthusiasm to really show up and vote one way or another maybe doesn't have the sports metaphor that we're talking about today, but still, I think it's really real, right? You still have people who really believe in a project, a new school perhaps, or infrastructure for a community, and you have others that don't. We haven't had that enthusiasm about those elections that I've seen here, at least in this state, when it impacts your pocketbook, right?
That's absolutely right.
You have to pay.
When we ask about the sport of politics, I think we can ask a bunch of different questions that go down different, you know, avenues of discussion. We can ask about the spectacle of politics, right? The images, the symbolism, the photo ops, the insults and all of that kind of thing, right? The things that are designed to enhance the entertainment value of politics. We can also talk about the competition element of politics, where what it is mano a mano, right? That you have to face someone on their own terms, and you want to try to get them to face you on your terms. You and I were having a conversation earlier off the air about Donald Trump being in a defensive posture rather than an offensive posture, and how that makes this election very different than the last election. There's that boxing sense again. If you are up against the ropes, the idea that you can come out swinging and prevail is, it's much harder to believe. It's much harder to have faith in. So that there is that element of the person against person competitive element. But then there's also this collective identity about sports. I am not a huge sports fan. And one of the things that has always puzzled me the most is what I always call the sports we. And the sports we is, you know, you watch a game, your team does really well, and all your friends stand up and say, "We won, we won, we won." And my response is, "You didn't win. You sat on the couch, ate buffalo wings, and these unbelievable athletes woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning to lift weights and run so that they could, you know, engage in this very particular kind of human excellence." But we identify with the teams. We see ourselves as teams that, you know, there's all the stories that have a certain element of truth in them, that that instances of domestic violence go down when the local team wins and go up when the local team loses. The level of personal identification for an audience and a team or fans and their teams is awe-inspiring in the literal sense of the term. Donald Trump has been able to exploit that in the past. Donald Trump has been able to get his followers to really identify him with him the way that Yankees fans identify with the Yankees. I don't know that the Democrats have been able to do that. And I think that that's part of what their message of joy is trying to do. Tim Walz as a candidate, Coach Walz, and the ultimate Upper Midwestern dad, right? There's a video of him going around now where, you know, someone asks him, you know, "What's your hot take?" And his answer is that the most neglected part of the house is the gutters. And then he gives a little lesson on how to, you know, how to clean your gutters and how to judge other people for not having clean gutters. And so once you have someone in that father role, you're starting to identify. But familial relationships are different than sports relationships. And so the question is, can the Democrats reclaim that level of group identity that is required to overcome the really, really intimate connection that Trump and his supporters have?
What I've wondered, Jack, after contemplating this question, really, if you go way back in history and you know a lot more about political movements historically from a political philosophy standpoint than I do, really, isn't it always been like a sport? We're competing. I am trying to beat you because I feel I can do a better job perhaps than you, or I want this because of X. Hasn't it always been this way?
I actually don't think so. I think that there was a shift in and around the 18th century that it became a sport and ceased to be war. War is a more apt metaphor because people were really, you know, people were killing each other literally. And the stakes were not just who's going to govern and who makes decisions, but who's going to survive and whose children are going to rule and whether the land stays in the family and things like that. So you get this period of political sport in Greece and Rome. And then you get the church intrigue, and you get this notion that all of the politicking is behind the scenes. That's, by the way, where devil's advocate, the phrase devil's advocate, comes from. Traditionally, when they're going to decide on a pope, they make their decision, they get the person who they're going to select, they gather in the Sistine Chapel, and then someone is declared the devil's advocate. And that is the person who represents the criticism of the pope, the criticism of the candidate. And they are supposed to tell, speak like with devil's tongue, they're supposed to say absolutely everything bad they can think of the papal candidate. And if that pope can survive that tongue lashing, so to speak, then they become the pope, and then the smoke changes in the Sistine Chapel and they announce who the pope is. That's not sport. That's something dirtier. That's something uglier. That's something really in the darkness of humanity. And that's why devil's advocate is such an excellent name.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Frist Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life at the University of North Dakota. Jack, ethically, does it change a candidate's mind if they are, in fact, treating this like an athletic event, like a sport, in, I'm going to win, I'm going to beat you?
You know, I've always struggled with this, too, because as much as there are certain politicians I admire, you do have to be a certain kind of narcissist to get at this level of politics, right? Sure. You have to be comfortable with everyone watching you all the time. You have to be comfortable with all of the smallest words, you know, or the slight comments you make having global implications. And even more importantly, and this is the part that really makes me uncomfortable, you have to be willing to make life and death decisions about other people. You have to decide which disease gets the attention. You have to decide which country gets our assistance. You have to decide which catastrophe is considered an emergency and gets national assistance and which doesn't. And of course, there are people to help you with the decision, and you have a staff, and you're surrounded, hopefully, by brilliant, brilliant people. But ultimately, the buck stops there, right? Ultimately, the president is the person who makes all those decisions. And I think that once you're at that level, I think once you're at that point, you're so profoundly competitive, right? You're so involved in the competition that just calling it sport may even be an understatement. What they say about Barack Obama is that he is an unimaginably competitive person, whether it's playing pool or cards or winning the election or basketball, he wants to win all of the time. And I just can't imagine getting past a certain level of political power and not having that in your DNA.
I wonder too, Jack, you hear the term selling your soul, and who sells their soul just so that they can win, just so that they can win the election? What do they have to give up? It reminds me of former Senator Heitkamp said the votes and the decisions that she is least proud of are ones that she made just to support the company line, the party line, that weren't necessarily in line with her personal beliefs. yet she had to make that judgment, right? What do I do? Do I stand up for myself or do I support the party here in this sport of politics? As we all know, the term politics is a contact sport, right?
The tragedy is actually most evident if we adjust the question just slightly and say, what happens if you sold your soul and you lost? Right? J.D. Vance, one of the accusations is, of course, he was famously opposed to Trump, and he said some really horrible things about Trump. And now he is all in on Trump 100% of the time. If he wins, there's a part of me, there's a part of all of us that said, all right, he did what he needed to win, right? Whether or not we like that, or whether or not we want an uncorrupted soul, in your term, at the helm, there's still something in us that intuitively accepts the winner's side. Or think about Governor Burgum, who himself had tremendous criticisms against Trump, and then was vying for the vice presidential spot, according to all reports, might be vying for a cabinet position, according to at least some reports. And then if he loses, what's it going to be like to be Governor Burgum? Can he claim the moral high ground? And I think that's the answer to your question. I think that once you sell your soul, you no longer have access to the moral high ground. You can't claim to be a moral authority in a way that you would beforehand. Whether or not you like Bernie Sanders, whether or not you like AOC, you can't deny that there are people who regard them with genuine moral authority and genuine conviction that if they were to sell themselves for it, would really undermine the public image that both their supporters and their enemies have of them. And then what do you have left? And that's the ultimate soul question, right? That's the core of the religious question about your soul. Once you give up your soul, what do you have left? And the answer is you are a shell of yourself and you are condemned, whether that's for all eternity or just in the public eye.
But are you? Caveats that, you know, I was just doing the right thing for North Dakota.
Right.
Getting on the Trump train in this particular example, because I knew that would be the best for North Dakota. And now North Dakota lives on, and I'm going to still fight for North Dakota. I'm just going to find other ways to do it.
That is if we find that argument believable. If we find that argument believable, they win. If we don't find that argument believable, we don't win. And so then, again, there's that level of sort of trust, that moral conviction. What's the difference between a quarterback who works incredibly hard and makes a judgment call and misses, right? And loses the Super Bowl because of it, because they ran one play and then
called an audible.
What's the difference between that and the quarterback who we find betting illegally on their own game? Right?
Arch Leister.
Exactly right. Right? The quarterback who made the genuine mistake, we may be mad at them, but we will stand with them through the pain and the tragedy of losing. The quarterback that betrayed us, the quarterback that sold their soul for the money or whatever, what would it mean to find redemption in that context? And again, now we're moving from sports to religious metaphors, but the famous phrase, there's no second act in politics. What does it mean to be redeemed? And Joe Biden is the perfect example of someone who is really struggling because so many people lost faith with him after that debate. So many people were personally hurt at the prospect, even if it were untrue, at the prospect that he was hiding dementia, that all of these people were working in tandem to keep this away from him. And so many people were so personally violated in their own minds by the loss of that debate. And he gets up and he says, okay, fine, I am going to drop out. In order for us to win, in order for the country to win, depending obviously on your perspective, but in order for me to show you that I still deserve your moral approval, I am going to step down. And instantly he became a hero. Instantly, those of his supporters were, his supporters just gushed, and even many of his opponents walked away saying, this was a noble deed, and whether I agree with him or not, this is a person whom I respect. And to watch that in real time was fascinating as a philosopher and profoundly moving as an American citizen.
It really was. I look at media, Jack, and I look at, obviously, you have Fox News, you have MSNBC, you have media that is very, very right and media that's very left. And to use the sports analogy, I look at Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark. No one in the media wants those two to be best friends. They want them to be villains and dislike one another when they compete and maybe even play dirty to win, et cetera, et cetera. And aren't we like that too in the media? We talk about these issues from one side or the other. One of the other things we spoke of earlier is, are there folks that never want us to agree on anything so that we can be divisive with one another rather than united?
I think that that's a really, really important point, because if you look at cable news before and after the 24-hour cycle, right, once CNN headline news invented the all the news all the time thing, the closest thing to political punditry was sportscasting, right, was all of these people before or after the game talking about all the plays, talking about what to anticipate. There's a wonderful book about the North Carolina Duke. A rivalry called To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever.
UND and NDSU?
They do not have the vitriol that the Carolinians have because we're North Dakotans are two of the land, two of the earth. The Carolinians are a different issue. But anyway, to hate like this is to be happy forever. The thing about sports is there are no real consequences. The thing about sports is, unless you're a player and you get, you know, a lot of money or a concussion or something, there are no real consequences. You can be depressed, you can go into a dark place, but in the great scheme of things, someone winning or losing,
our team winning,
right,
or losing,
yeah, it doesn't really matter unless you decide it means something to you. Politics, on the other hand, absolutely matters, and it matters on the most local level, and it matters on the most global level. And so if you lose, you are facing consequences that you yourself might find terrifying and profoundly impacting. And so that means that no matter how much we try to reduce it to sports, there's always going to be a level of impact that we can't override. But at the same time, that 24-hour network, just talking head, relentless voice, resembles nothing more to me than sportscasters trying to get people enthused, trying to talk about how the other team isn't just bad, they're evil. God is on our side, and our job is to make sure that the fans who don't understand that stay on their side of the arena. Our roads we will not cross. I can't think of the phrase, but you know what I'm saying.
Does the term sport politics undermine its importance has been our topic of discussion. We meet with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein once a month for our segment called Philosophical Currents. We're going to work on a walk-up song for Jack. We're going to continue the sports metaphor in that regard in our future discussions. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy at Public Life at the University of North Dakota. It's always so great to visit with you, Jack.
Oh, Greg, it's such a pleasure. I love this segment, and I think that you've given it new life, and I couldn't be more thrilled.
I'm wearing my St. Louis Cardinals shirt with my University of Wyoming banner in the background. Jack, with all of his computers and tripods and other things in the back of his background that we're looking at here as we visit. Jack, it's always a pleasure.